Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm excited to have Joanna Brooks and Natasha Helfer Parker with me tonight. We are going to take a page from the news, which was, well, it's not certainly super recent news, but it's the bombing and the murderous rampage in Oslo, Norway, in which a person with strong ideological views committed terrible acts. And we're also going to tie it in a little bit with the news that came down recently of the sentencing of Warren Jeffs, prophet from the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And we're just going to take those two things, and we're going to say, let's talk about worldviews. Let's talk about how people construct worldviews, especially the role that religious worldviews play sometimes in folks who seem to get their wires crossed and go down wrong paths. And so I've brought these two brilliant people on with me because I love their generous hearts, their great minds, their real good common sense, as well as their expertise in worldviews and psychological issues and things like that. So thank you both very much for being on. Joanna, would you mind quickly reintroducing yourself to our listeners? You're by far our most frequent guest here, but there might be people joining us for the first time.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Joanna Brooks. I blog regularly about Mormonism and Mormon life and politics at religiondispatches.org. And I also have a column at Feminist Mormon Housewives called Ask Mormon Girl.
Great. And you're an English professor at San Diego State, but a lot of your work deals with religious themes, or how is it that you, I know that you just are really bright and strong in worldview construction.
Did you just say I'm strong in worldview construction?
Well, I mean, you have a real good feel for it.
I do have a worldview. Watch out. I will impose it on my children. I'm an American literary historian by training. Most of my work has focused on how religion shapes communities, and it's been early American and looking at race, especially African American, Native American communities. These days, I'm writing a lot about Mormonism in one of those very interesting life transitions, and I'm finding that studying religion is a good way to understand who we are on the contemporary landscape.
Terrific. Thank you. Natasha Parker, welcome back to the show. We're grateful to have you, and give us a quick overview of the things that you do.
Well, hi, Dan, and thanks so much for having me back. It's always a great pleasure. So I'm a marriage and family therapist. I got my undergraduate at BYU in psychology and then my master's degree at Friends University here in Wichita. I have a private practice and I run a blog called The Mormon Therapist, which is kind of an advice column. And I also blog at Feminist Mormon Housewives and just sometimes host some interviews at Mormon Stories.
You do indeed, and really good. It's wonderful interviews, and I know lots of our listeners think the world of you. So thank you both for joining.
Wow, thanks.
Joanna, if you don't mind, we were talking a little bit ahead of time, and you mentioned that that you wouldn't mind taking the assignment of at least outlining Anders Behring Breivik, or Breivik. How do you say it? It's been a while since I listened to the news. Breivik?
Breivik, I think.
Okay. Tell us what's going on there. I mean, there was a lot of different framings, and especially in the earlier going, it was like, obviously it was an ideologically driven thing, but was he acting out of a Christian framework, et cetera? So I'd love just sort of an overview of what you think are the most interesting issues at play in the Oslo tragedy.
Gladly. And, you know, and I want to refer people to, I'm going to draw on some work that my colleagues at religiondispatches.org did in, you know, in the hours following the shooting. I was on Twitter following people like Sarah Posner and Jeff Charlotte, who some of our listeners might know, writes widely about religion in American life. And, you know, folks had gotten their hands on Breivik's 1,500-page manifesto within hours of the shooting and were reading through and relaying bits of it. And then, you know, some very good articles came out in the days afterwards that give us a pretty coherent view of his motives as expressed in his manifesto. And so I just wanted to give a shout out to those folks. I mean, Mormons, we like to read about ourselves, but, you know, it's good to read about other religions sometimes too, and the broader religious world we move in. So I'm gonna summarize some of what my colleagues, very smart people, put together to give folks a picture of the mindset. In the U.S., especially with, for example, the shooting in Arizona by Jared Loughner, you know, we're prone to look for, you know, we're habituated to look for mental illness components. We're not ruling that out, but we're also saying that, unlike Jared Loughner, and if you followed that and viewed his YouTube presentations, which were quite nonsensical, you know, there is a coherent worldview that Breivik assembled and was seeking to enact through destruction. Now, he chose July 22nd for the date of the massacre. That happened to be the day back in, get out your medieval histories, 1099, that the Kingdom of Jerusalem was established during the First Crusade. So he very consciously was modeling his act of violence after the great European crusades of the Middle Ages to reclaim the Holy Land from, quote, infidels. The title of his 1,500-page manifesto, which he posted on the internet, was 2083. And that year date marks the 400th anniversary of a battle in 1683, the Battle of Vienna, when the Ottoman Empire was sort of decisively ousted from Europe. And why these dates matter is because Breivik was positioning himself and his act of violence sort of in the hopes of igniting a pushback against what he perceived as Islamic incursion into Europe. So he's modeling himself after crusades historically and consciously after anti-Islamic battles in European history. Now, folks who made it through the 1,500-page manifesto, which I didn't, but I'm relying on some good people, you know, it has two main thrusts in the argumentative portion of the manifesto. One is, as clear now from the dates that Breivik chose, is that Europe is under siege by Muslim invaders. That would be his word, not mine. And to him, that's through immigration. But also, and this is the second element of his argument, through modern leftist intellectuals who have made Christendom soft on difference. So he's writing from what he perceives as the heart of the European Christian Empire, the former European Christian Empire, and identifying strongly culturally as a Christian. I'll get to that in a second, and suggesting that 20th century intellectual movements like Marxism, like feminism — he's very explicitly anti-feminist and accuses feminists of emasculating European men — like literary theory, deconstructionism, that these intellectual movements have made Europe soft on difference, and that it's time for Europeans to stand up and reclaim and defend their empire against Muslim invaders. And, you know, the book has his 1,500-page manifesto. It has a bibliography. People who have a sordid past in grad school would recognize authors in the bibliography, like Emanuel Wallerstein, Eric Hobsbawm, who are sort of theorists and economic historians. It includes some how-to portions. It includes a journal and some photographs. And so that's the thrust of his reasoning, as expressed in his 1,500-page manifesto. And I'll leave it there for now as a summary introduction.
That's terrific, and I appreciate that reminder. You know, like everything else, you pay good attention for that first week or two, and then you kind of forget about it. So it was good to have the reminders of that. Did he include any autobiographical clues or hints to this that would sort of at least give us a jumping off point for how does one go about taking on a worldview that that wouldn't be coherent for other people? You know what I mean? How is it that does it give any clues to psychology or
mean?
Yeah? Well, no. Just I guess to why somebody like him would be prone to this sort of reasoning.
I haven't seen that in the accounts of those who have studied the 1500-page manifesto closely. His emphasis seemed to be strategic and theoretical. And he laid out plans for sort of reforming a Knights Templar-like organization modeled after sort of medieval Catholicism, like an armed faction of Christian empire. I mean, so he was very projective. He projected a worldview. He didn't confess a great deal. He did talk, and I'll read a quote here. It's really interesting. He did talk a little bit about his own faith system, and it's significant. And he writes, "If you have a personal relationship with Jesus," and this is Breivik, "if you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ and God, then you are a religious Christian. Myself and many more like me do not necessarily have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ and God. We do, however, believe in Christianity as a cultural, social identity, and moral platform. This makes us Christians." And he talks kind of about how he's not a very religious person, but he does cite scripture as a legitimator of violence, and does state towards the end that he's pretty sure he will be praying for strength as he carries out his plans.
Interesting. Natasha?
Yes.
when you encounter somebody with that coherent a worldview, but obviously one that very, very, very few people would be tempted to adopt or to think in that kind of clean terms and to dehumanize people and you know they're serving some larger political purpose and I'm an actor in it and stuff, what jumps into your brain as far as a psychological triggers or factors that sometimes lead people down roads like that?
Well, just to be clear, I'm not a forensic psychologist, and quite frankly, I have not come across what we would consider these types of people. I mean, persons who are seriously mentally ill are probably going to be far more likely to be the victims of crime rather than the perpetrators of crime, I mean, statistically speaking. So these are kind of rare cases, and they probably fall mostly under personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, which is somewhat misleading a name to probably the lay public, but because it doesn't mean that they don't want to be social. It's much more, it's I guess much more complex than that. But the main things that happen with antisocial personality disorder is that you do have you don't have regard for laws or rules, you don't have regard for authority, you really have no remorse when you hurt other people. So you start really having some really problematic behaviors, and many criminals would fall under somewhat near that diagnosis who are at this level of illness. So it's a complex issue. And when you ask me what comes to mind, well, a lot of things come to mind because what causes mental illness to begin with is a very, it's the question of the century, if not of humanity. So it's a complicated issue. And there's a lot of, if anybody's taken Psych 101, the first thing that they start talking to you about is nature versus nurture, which means, are we talking about biological forces and genetic forces? Are we talking about environmental forces? And, usually there's a good case for both. And when it comes to these kinds of criminals, such as Anders Breivik, is it Breivik?
Breivik.
I wouldn't be surprised that if you go back into the family chart, there would be, some psychological issues there in the family history. So I'm sure there's probably some genetic components that come to play. Now, do genetic components mean that we're destined to be criminals? Not necessarily. Usually there need to be stressors of an environmental nature to kind of set the genetic proponents in motion. And so then come into play a lot of different things. Did you grow up in an abusive home? Did you grow up in a religion that had kind of, you know, strict ideas about it or rigid ideas? Did you grow up in a culture that had, you know, certain ideas about criminality or, you know, whatever? So the list can go on, and you just never can quite come down to one root cause as to why certain people behave in this manner. One other thing that I just want to throw out there too is that one thing that can happen to our brains is actual damage. So, I mean, if there's been some type of head injury or something along those lines, even as a child or a baby, that those things have been shown to, you know, change personalities or to, there's been a few cases where, you know, you have a certain person and they have a severe head injury and they survive it. And even though they survive and their intellect is in place, their family members note that their personality is quite different. So those are all things that can, you know, play out here. And I'm sure I'm leaving out 500 other things. So
thank you. This is Mormon Matters, of course, and I think the religious piece is probably of greatest concern. At least I would guess that most people listening would be interested in more exploration of that. And I do want to go into Warren Jeffs a little bit. You know, that's just an extreme case that I think we can talk to a little bit more down the road. But right now, Natasha or Joanna, especially both of you, have been studying thought systems and worldviews and sort of this all-encompassing point of view, you know, our largest theories of reality and what's the most important and whatnot. What would you say is the role of religion in all this? Some people want to say that if it weren't for religion, half of these terrorists would never show up. Is that too simple? What is it that what is it about religion that makes people think that it's almost like a root cause rather than just an overlay or something that the deeper disorder manifests itself through?
Well, let's go back a little bit, and this is something I'd love to dialogue with Natasha about. You know, intellectual historians talk about the emergence of mental illness as a category of health as something that's happened in modernity, right? We haven't always viewed the mentally ill as their own category of being, and we haven't established that that's really what's going on with Breivik. But, you know, there are lots of people in religious history whose excessive and visionary and odd behaviors have been viewed through a religious frame instead of through a medical or therapeutic frame. And so there's something really interesting about beginning to peel back the layers of, you know, what exactly qualifies as mental illness, and, you know, are there common roots in extreme religious expression and mental illness that we should kind of look at and examine before we put mental illness in a class of its own? I don't know. Does that make sense to you, Natasha?
Yeah, I think that this is a concern of definition. And you're right. I mean, there's definitely, you know, 300 years ago or whenever ago, many things that people came up with were just considered either visions or, you know, maybe a demon had overtaken somebody. I mean, that's pretty common to see in scriptural cases. And now looking at those stories, is that really a demon or was there a mental illness involved, you know? And then at some level, if you're going to be a spiritual minded person, what's the difference between the two? You know, so, I mean, you could go into the philosophy and theology of that for a long time, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I think that the current definition of a delusion is obviously a belief or a thought process that is really outside of the norm and that's false. But the piece that I think makes it most interesting as far as how to categorize it as a delusion is that it's not accepted by the larger culture. Mm-hmm. So most of us, you know, believe in God, for instance. I think we're at 92% in the United States and 80% worldwide that believe in a higher power. So some people could say, well, that's a delusional type of belief. Nobody has seen God, or, you know, only a few people have purportedly seen God, but there's no proof of God. And so why isn't that a delusion? But it's accepted by the larger culture, and so nobody considers that as a weird, you know, belief system. So that, yeah, I mean, we could go off on that for hours as far as why that is. And so I guess that to me, it goes back to, you know, Dan, your original question as to, well, are we just better off without religion? And if we didn't have religion, would these types of things happen? I don't know that we're in a position worldwide where we can even begin to study that, because the majority of people do believe in a higher power. And so I don't think that there's enough evidence per se that and even people who purport not to believe in a higher power many times have been quite affected by a belief of a higher power in their childhood. So they've just abandoned it as an adult. So I don't know that we could even really broach that question correctly. Now, I will say that, you know, there are non-religious organizations that have also produced, you know, very zealot type people who have done criminal type things. I mean, a classic thought, even though it didn't really involve murder, is, you know, the people that throw paint on women's fur coats, right? So they're doing a criminal act and they're not being caring about somebody's personal property, but because they have a very zealous idea of, you know, something that they believe in very strongly. So that mimics maybe a religious belief, but it's not necessarily religious. So I don't think it's that simple to say if religion wasn't here. Plus, statistically too, with as many people who believe in a higher God, there are not really that many cases of things like this happening. So, I mean, they do happen, and they're awful when they do happen, and they're unfortunate, of course, but I think that these statistics, if religion was the root cause, then we would have a lot more, you know, of these types of incidents.
One other thing we talk about sometimes, you know, in cultural studies, when we talk about behaviors that are deemed criminal, is whether those behaviors are expressions of aberrance, you know, of a behavior that's clearly outside the norm, or whether they're extreme expressions of more accepted, you know, forms of behavior and ideologies. So, you know, when we call someone, when we attribute something to mental illness or imbalanced thinking, it's interesting to think about whether they're acting out ideologies and sentiments that are, you know, already circulating and fairly accepted, but they're just doing it in ways that are extreme. And, you know, people who have studied Breivik's declaration, his manifesto, have shown that he's been paying attention to folks in the United States like Pam Geller, who is a blogger and a media personality who's really made a career for herself basically by being anti-Islamic in the last couple of years since 9/11. You know, he cites people that are in our popular culture, for better or worse, mainstream here in the U.S., as being in support of his worldview. It's just what he does with that worldview that carries him beyond, you know, the bounds, I think. I don't know, Natasha, does that distinction operate in your world, extreme versus aberrant?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's a continuum of behavior and of thought, and the, you know, that's why I think mental health is really an art form. I mean, you have, you know, everybody's along a continuum. I mean, for instance, if you're going to diagnose somebody with even something as simple as depression, well, we're all depressed at some points of our lives, and we all probably have some of the symptoms that are in the DSM-4 at some point of our lives. So when does it actually cross the line into clinical depression? And so that is somewhat of an art form. In some cases, it's very clear, and in other cases, it's more mild or moderate. And so do we just treat with psychotherapy, or do we add a medication? You know, is it serious enough for that? So, I mean, yeah, with every single disorder and every single mental illness, there is a continuum involved. And all of us at some level have symptoms of probably most of the diagnoses in the DSM-4, because we all deal with stress and we all deal with anxiety and we all deal with, you know, kind of the human condition. So, yeah, it's difficult. But, you know, obviously in cases like this, he crossed a line where most, I think, you know, 99.9 of people in this world would say that's an extreme behavior. However, I think what you're getting at, and maybe where religion plays more of a role than in these extreme cases, is where does it fit in kind of on the extreme normal behaviors, right?
Ah, yes.
So nobody's killing anybody, but, you know, like you're saying, there's people blogging or very passionate about certain topics, and we have very heated feelings about certain things. I mean, abortion comes to mind, and, you know, of course, all the discrimination against Islamic people, and there's a lot of different kind of hot topics, homosexuality, you know, and marriage with allowing marriage between homosexuals. So there's a lot of people that have very heated feelings, and you know, and depending where you're at on that continuum, you may look at somebody else and say, well, those, they're kind of kooky, or they're kind of, you know, they don't really make sense to me. but, you know, they're not doing anything criminal. They're just voting maybe in a way that you're not in agreement with. So,
you know, it reminds me of a great conversation. And I know a lot of listeners of this podcast know the wonderful Heather Olson Beal. You know, and she talks about the story of Abraham. I heard her talk about the story of Abraham, right? And here's a man who claims he's heard voices to kill his son from God, you know, and, you know, raises all sorts of questions about, you know, what God's intention is and what extreme behavior is. And of course, we all know how the story of Abraham turns out. But, you know, Heather says, you know, today that is not a useful story on which to pattern behavior. If anyone today hears voices, you just need to call hears voices telling you to kill someone, you just need to call the police, you know?
Right.
And so there's this interesting difference between, you know, we're expected to acquire, it seems, some kind of a critical apparatus, although I don't think it's very well articulated about what constitutes inappropriate behavior in the service of a religious worldview. I mean, where are we taught that, except for in kind of the canons of criminal law? What do you think, Natasha?
Well, and this is where I am willing to hold religion responsible, or maybe more than just religion, religious leaders, including our Mormon leaders. I think that a lot of times over the pulpit, and especially, you know, worldwide pulpits such as General Conference or wherever other leaders may speak, they're kind of talking to the lowest common denominator. You know, they're talking to people who maybe are really doing very bad things. But the problem is that most of the people listening to those messages aren't necessarily in those boats. And so the way that it's presented, or at least what I notice in our Mormon culture, is that it's presented very black and white. And I think there was even, well, I know there was a comment even this last conference where we're not to be cafeteria Mormons, right? So you're just supposed to do every single thing that is said. And that is concerning when you look at the Bible. And even the Book of Mormon, there's a lot of violent themes in there. So that's, you know, how do you know, for instance, that it was okay for Nephi to kill Laban? Because, you know, Nephi didn't have a prophet who told him to do that. Nephi did that directly with his relationship with God. And so at what point, and I think that was the point that was brought up in the Lafferty case, in the book Under the Banner of Heaven, is, you know, the Lafferty brothers kind of went along that line of thinking. So I think the majority of people understand that we're not to go around killing people like Nephi did. But I believe that there are enough people struggling with either forms of mental illness or other problems that need a clear message that violence is not to be used. You know, even if you hear a voice or, you know, anything along those lines. And I think that what happens is that the leaders are maybe afraid to discredit these scriptural accounts, and they don't want to do that. And I can understand that. I mean, I think the scriptural stories have a lot of great morals and lessons and values to teach. But when they don't take those things into account, then it allows for when people are on the fringes of their mental health and are considering doing, you know, very criminal, destructive acts, either to others or to themselves, then we have somewhat of a disconnect with the leaders reaching out and speaking to those people.
This is terrific. Thank you for the wonderful back and forth. I love it when I don't jump in.
You want to talk to us, Dan? You want to handle this?
Well, there's been two or three things that come along, and I'm trying to think.
It's
of
your show.
Hey, woohoo! I'm in charge. Let me pick one that came up, and I guess it was maybe towards the end that this one started to hit me as maybe a nice thing to seg into. I'm thinking about isolationism. I'm thinking about Breivik alone with his computer with these voices out there, and he's only paying attention to the one worldview. And I'm thinking of Warren Jeffs, who was raised in a religious community that, you know, was fundamentalist. It was authoritarian. There was a disconnect from the outside world. And so I guess I'd love both of you to reflect a little bit, or whatever this prompts in you, to talk about the interplay between things going haywire and the idea that you're not hearing multiple voices. You're not getting to check your reality against other viewpoints. Does that make some sense as a fruitful area to go into?
Yeah, although this is a problem on many different levels, because this is the classic us versus them, and it can go down to one individual, like Anders Breivik, who's just off by himself. I'm assuming that's what he was. He wasn't part of a group. And so his little group is just he, himself, and him, you know, him. And but then even though you may break out and, you know, maybe you have a group of four, if you're all thinking the same way, even though you're not officially isolated and you actually might be quite social with those people, you're still isolated in your worldview, which is what Joanna can speak to better than me probably. But that can even happen in larger cultures. It can be 100 people, it can be 1,000 people. I think that this happens within every single culture. It's the us versus them mentality. And it's a very natural response. We all do it. We all label. We all kind of try to organize our worldview in different ways. And we do that by trying to make distinctions. So it's actually normal and healthy to do that. But it doesn't help us necessarily in becoming more nuanced and accepting of the differences that are out there, because that raises anxiety and natural anxiety.
Have I proposed anything that made you think of anything, Joanna?
Well, I'm thinking about Warren Jeffs, and particularly because, I mean, what I find fascinating about Breivik in contradistinction to someone like Warren Jeffs is he's not coming from a culture where there is a tradition of prophetic inspiration to the one, right? He, from what we know, he's modeled himself after medieval Catholicism. He has some criticisms of the contemporary Catholic Church, but he sort of wants to be part of a new Christian army that will repel, you know, the perceived invaders and reestablish empire. Good luck. All sorts of empires are shaping and reshaping in the world right now, and we're not going back. But, you know, I think then about Warren Jeffs, right? Growing up in a culture, you know, within the broader Mormon movement, perhaps an extreme culture, I'll call it an ultra-Orthodox culture, where there was a tradition, even in a very small community, of individuals claiming authority to receive prophetic inspiration on, you know, inspiration on behalf of others, and claiming the mantle of prophet, and even within fundamentalist LDS communities, competing prophet mantles, you know, led to intra-group violence, you know, as different men battled it out to be a prophet and to establish a prophetic dominion. And there's something about that, you know, the way the prophetic impulse to the one bounces against or stands in tension with the codes that the many are supposed to observe as people of faith, right? Because if you don't break the Ten Commandments, you're probably not going to massacre anybody, right? You know, like there's some basic codes that we take on as religious people, codes of conduct that keep our communities more or less orderly. But in a culture where there's a prophetic tradition, and especially one like the FLDS, there is tension between the one and the many. And so I think that's fascinating to reflect on. But, you know, I think what may be more operative, Dan, is what you're getting at is this idea of isolation. Because, again, you know, this is not a characteristic of all people who practice polygamy or all people who identify as fundamentalist Mormons. But, you know, the FLDS is an extreme branch even of the larger fundamentalist movement, and have become increasingly extreme in the last, you know, 15 to 20 years under Jeff's leadership, setting themselves apart even in refusing to associate even with other fundamentalist Mormons in the Short Creek community. So you have this community that's getting ever more isolated, even to the point where men who disagree with the prophetic mantle of leadership are ejected from the community, young men especially. And so you have this echo chamber develop where all sorts of distorted thinking take hold, and there's no one left to challenge them in a robust way for the good of the community. And I think that's a really fascinating issue to reflect on. Like, what is our obligation as people who belong to a historically prophetic culture to consider the viewpoints of others, right? To not be in isolation. so that not only do we have the Ten Commandments guarding us, you know, from committing extreme acts, but we have a sense of humility and of deference to other worldviews, keeping us from committing extreme acts in a way that, that Breivik was not able to.
Well,
terrific. Go ahead, please.
I have like five different discombobulated thoughts here, so bear with me. Well, my first thought goes to your last point, and this was, I'm going to give out a shout out here to Mormon Expression, but I just listened to their podcast with David Campbell, and he was talking about his book, American Grace. I don't know if you've heard of that. Mm-hmm. But yes. He talks a lot about how one of the things that was interesting to me was that Mormons in general seem to have a pretty nice worldview of other religions. So I think that's one thing that actually our leadership has done very well on. I think that, you know, they've done a very good job of more than a few times talking about, you know, accepting others of other faiths, that there's truth in all faiths, that we need to embrace others and be charitable. And so I think that as a message that the leadership has done very well on is that of inclusion of other peoples. And I think we've rated highest of any other religion on this. Of course, it was ironic because everybody did not feel the same way about us, but
right.
At least we're right. Loving and optimistic towards others. So I do think as a Mormon faith, we've done that well. Going back to the isolation versus prophetic and things like that, one thing that I will say that, you know, I'm a huge fan of the internet because I believe that that's dramatically changed worldviews and educated many people who otherwise, you know, would not have had things accessible to them. But in some respects, we can't expect that Anders Breivik was completely isolated. Even though he may have been on his own socially and physically, it's very easy to go on the internet and find other views that support your own, especially some that are very, you know, again, on the fringes of what we would consider normal. And so I'm sure that even though he was crossing a line, he could find information in other people that in his, you know, thinking supported his ideas.
Right. But that's similar to Warren Jeffs, though. It's an isolation in that you're really only still hearing one track of thought. It's like people that get all their politics from Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and whatnot. At a certain point, don't you, if that's all you listen to, that's all you're going to believe.
Right. So my point is it doesn't need to be within a prophetic culture. It can happen anywhere. And I think it's when people, because people seek what they know and what they think. So, you know, I'm sure that Breivik had all kinds of opportunity to look on the internet for beliefs that maybe wouldn't coincide with his, but did he choose to look at those? I highly doubt it. So he stuck with what he felt comfortable with, what he believed, and then that exacerbated the problem. So in some sense, we're no longer isolated in the sense of we're just by ourselves.
Right.
We are part of a bigger world culture, and we do tend to seek what we already know and believe. And that is a problem, I think, of just humanity in general. That's going back to the us versus them kind of mentality. And then this is why I'm feeling discombobulated, because I'm in a tangent here, so feel free to reel me in. But going back to propheticism in general and what we would consider a delusion, for instance, if, you know, a 14-year-old boy came into church and said, you know, I had a vision and I saw God and Jesus and they were talking to me, I mean, yeah, there might be a psychiatric visit today, there might be a diagnosis of schizophrenia or something along those lines. And, you know, just 100 years ago, that was much more accepted. So, you know, that's a conundrum. And I've heard many people kind of comment on those types of things. At the same time, you know, I do want to say that 80% of Americans still believe in miracles. And it's interesting how we all have certain kind of feelers that we kind of understand whether or not somebody is in our own realm. So I can listen, for instance, to somebody in my office tell me that they've had a spiritual experience and maybe even talk about it almost like a vision or an experience, something that they've really felt and it was very powerful for them. And my red flags don't go up. You know, as a mental health professional, I see lots of Mormons who talk to me about their spiritual lives and things that they've felt. or, you know, experiences even within their family. We have a lot of great pioneer stories and things like that, that families love those spiritual stories. But then you have somebody else come into your office, and by the way they say their experience, or, you know, the smaller types of intricacies of communication, you start going, maybe something's, you know, not quite right here. And so what makes that person different from the other person? And a lot of that has to do with just, does it fit into the cultural context? Does it fit into the way that people kind of normally talk about these things? Is it more grandiose than it should be? Is that person saying they're going to follow through with something because of what they saw? There's a lot of different things, and some of it I can't even articulate into words. It's just behavior that I see or that feels right or wrong to me. Of course, this is where my... The what?
No. Finish your sentence. I just heard a word I want
to... I mean, this is where my own biases come in, too, as a, you know, as a therapist who believes in God and is Mormon. I mean, you know, that... Maybe a Mormon who would talk to a non-Mormon therapist about a spiritual experience, maybe red flags would go off for them, but they don't for me because I'm within that cultural context. So this is where it all gets very gray and very muddly. And, you know, would Joseph Smith even have the capacity to be a prophet today? Well, we do have prophets today, and, you know, they act in ways that we seem to culturally accept. But they're not saying that they've seen God and Jesus on the right hand, you know, like Joseph Smith did. So those are all things that are interesting to think about.
There's a word you use that I think that makes a lot of sense to me. I want to hear you talk a little bit more about what that means in a cultural sense. I mean, in a psychological sense, this idea of grandiosity, like how characterize or define grandiosity for us, please.
I wrote that one down too when you said it. I loved it, and immediately I flashed to Glenn Beck. So that may show you something.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I'm bad, but I don't know, somehow or other, this whole going to Jerusalem, you know, I sense there's this grandiosity of his place and role in history, and you know, anyway, just
he's a professional entertainer.
Okay,
anyway, go ahead.
Sorry about that, but go ahead, Natasha, please. Grandiosity, please.
Well, yeah, grandiosity kind of, it envelopes a lot of different concepts, but basically it's this idea that, yes, I'm very important, and, you know, whether that's important to a cause or to my family or individually, it usually is more than individual, you know, like usually I'm going to play a role. It's many times associated with narcissistic personality disorder, which is, you know, a thought that you're better than and more intelligent than and just everything than other people. It also can be something that doesn't necessarily happen with personality disorders, but it can happen in a psychotic episode, or it can happen in a manic episode, like if you're bipolar. So in other words, when you're manic, you're feeling full of energy and full of self-esteem that normally you don't have. So yeah, visions of grandiosity is, I'm awesome, I can do anything I set my mind to, I'm super important, without me, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, won't happen. So yeah, that's my lame attempt at trying to define
if you, if you were to see someone in a clinical setting, you know, what markers in their behavior, like, you know, gestures, eye contact, what kind of everyday behaviors would set your grandiosity trigger?
A lot of times people want to know if, like, for instance, they're my best client ever, or they'll make comments that are very disparaging about other people. Needing to feel like you're better than other people is that you really don't feel that great about yourself to begin with. Somebody with a personality disorder, though, wouldn't be able to accept that type of feedback. Mm-hmm. So it gets, complicated.
Dan, did you want to hop in on grandiosity?
Early on when she said something, you know, that it can appear in a manic episode, I was thinking clearly Breivik and others are able to sustain that view. So in other words, I think it's that idea of when it plays into, I have a role to play in history, I am a turning point figure, I've been called, you know, and so sometimes the religious piece, I've been called by God to do this, can come in. But then on the other hand, we certainly know that there's plenty of people in secular contexts that feel, you know, I don't know if called, but somehow or other driven ideologically to insert themselves into history in a completely, you know, non-normal way. I don't know.
Well, and I'm going to make a total leap here, which I'm going to almost hate myself for doing because I really don't want to put down Mormonism or really any other religion, but in a sense, each religion has its own form of grandiosity. I mean, a lot of these things are things that we think of as Mormons in a general culture. We're special. We're more special. We're the chosen people. These are kind of themes that are common in not only our religion, but religions in general. We have a special role to play in history. We're better than everybody else. We have the right way. You can stop me now if you'd like to.
Well, you know, it seems, too, that there's a second piece, too, in addition to grandiosity, that we see in Brevik and we see in others, and even within our own culture, which is that there's grandiosity, but there's also a sense of being embattled in history, that there are people out to get you, not in, like, a paranoid way. And, again, I don't mean to bleed into clinical language. That's not my suit. But I'm thinking about, for example, you know, Brevik's notion that Christendom – and for him, that's a cultural domain that maps pretty much onto, like, Aryan identity, basically. That Christendom is under attack by Islam and, you know, that lefties have opened the door and it's time to push back. And I think that that's a behavior that, again, falls on a spectrum of a continuum. You know, we see that, again, in our own culture, in our own religious worldview, in terms of being us against the world, you know, the Mormon persecution complex that gets up and running sometimes as well. I mean, so how does, and what kinds of factors, you know, trigger a person's sense of being embattled and therefore having license to act in ways that, you know, exceed norms of behavior, call off the rules, as it were?
Right. And so this is, again, where you find the spectrum idea useful because, you know, through Prop 8, that was definitely something that we did. We felt like we were going to battle against something. I'm talking about the Mormon church in general, not necessarily our personal views. You know, here we're going against something larger, you know, that we're going to be helpful in. And, you know, we're part of a cause. So we feel empowered in that. And it's almost like a call to action, call to battle type of mentality. Whether or not you agree with that, it falls under normal cultural laws and regulations. Nothing that happened was necessarily illegal in the sense of criminal or things like that. It all happened under our social construct, whether you agree with it or not. So what happens with people when they cross that line again is that, you know, we see much more impulsive, reckless behavior that now does not fall under those social constructs. And sometimes that line is interesting. Where does that line cross? The other thing I was going to bring up is this idea of death. And that's an interesting idea because when you're in a construct as a Christian or an Islamic person, I think most religions have some type of an idea of what happens to you after this life. And so for somebody who's mentally ill or just completely, you know, again, zealous about something, part of why there may not be remorse is because they know that there's something else for that person. I mean, when I see people who, for instance, are suicidal, or even the few that I've seen that are starting to become homicidal, they'll many times justify their actions. Well, you know, I know I'm going to meet with God and I'll figure it out then. Or, you know, they'll meet with God and they'll be in a better place. Or, you know, there's all these kinds of Christian and other beliefs about the afterlife that I think sometimes can stop the remorse from happening where it should happen, as far as really understanding the implications for this life. If you're so focused on the next life, then what you do in this life sometimes isn't as important to people who, again, are on the fringes.
Interesting. I was trying to formulate a thought there right at the end. If you do have a strong belief that there is nothing after this life, that life is brutal, life is, you know, there is no overriding purpose of thing, that seems like it possibly could work in the same way. You know, so if you're extreme and life has no meaning, there is no intrinsic value in a human being, would that lead to the same sort of thing, Natasha, would you say?
Yeah, it might, although I think that people that don't think that there's something else afterwards are going to be thinking about that a little bit more carefully because there's no going back. You know, if in a religion there's the chance for reincarnation or for, you know, having virgins, for killing yourself off, or, you know, all those kinds of things that we know are extreme, but they're there and they're usually scripturally based, then people might be more willing to take their chances. So I guess that's one small argument for, you know, let's just do away with religion altogether. But, you know, I think that that also downplays a lot of what religion does do and what it does offer people, which, again, when we're looking at the communities at large and the statistics of how many people are religious and what they get from that, not only personally, but communally, then that argument really falls apart very quickly.
Well, and I think it's important, too, to look at, you know, I mean, Breivik is someone who said that he wasn't spiritual. You know, I mean, he said, I don't have a personal relationship with God or Jesus, but I claim Christianity is a cultural identity. And European Christianity is a cultural identity. And so it seems that there's a very particular kind of, you know, religiosity, sans spirituality, that, you know, fosters grandiosity, that fosters a sense of disproportionate embattlement, entitlement, maybe even isolation. And that can feed the kind of mindsets you're getting at. But I don't think we should hang it on religion entirely, as long as the spirituality component is kept in there.
Going back to what I was speaking of earlier, there can be a lot of different reasons why people feel compelled to protect something. It doesn't necessarily have to be religious in nature. And so, you know, cultural identity has been one of those things. I mean, we see that, you know, through the Nazi movement. We see that through, I mean, that's what the Oklahoma City bombing was about, you know, was kind of more racist type philosophy. So, I mean, somebody could argue that a lot of that goes back to religion, and I'm not going to discount that, but they're not necessarily religious per se. Like, oh, you know, I'm going to do this and get some type of reward from my God. So, like you're saying, there wasn't a spiritual connection there, but there was other zealous beliefs about maybe protecting either his culture or his country. Or so these doing away with religion isn't going to solve our problem that we're still going to have psychopaths and sociopaths among us, because that's just part of our human condition.
At one point in probably 15 minutes ago or so, I wrote down, well, first of all, let me say, I'd like to take us home in the next 10 or 15 minutes. So I'd love to keep going down this path of what lessons can we learn from these extreme cases that make for healthy construction of our own worldviews and things like that. And just one of the thoughts, where, as you guys were starting to head us back, well, let's not blame religion only, is that ability of religion to articulate positive values that do encourage you to always be humble about your worldview, to always be open to spiritual correction, different things like that, and especially the communal aspect that you were talking about, Natasha, earlier, of meeting with people who fundamentally do not think just like you, and yet you're meeting them in contexts where you're seeing goodness, you're seeing them serving others, you see them being compassionate people, and yet, you know, you may completely disagree with them ideologically, and yet somehow or other the fact that you're in community with them forces you to stay open, to say, I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying? Just to get feedback that keeps your heart churning and you're constantly revisiting your own ideas.
Well, and community is a very slow endeavor. You know, community is a very slow, pragmatic endeavor that's really inimical to the kind of, you know, vast historical analyses and projections that Breivik was trying to make. I mean, that's why you have to write 1,500 pages by yourself, you know, in isolation, because what it means to be a part of a community. I mean, this is the wonderful part about religion and spirituality that kind of saves us from extreme individualistic and ideological viewpoints, is that you have to show up for other people all the time. And that showing up is often not glamorous. It's often, you know, fulfilling your callings and doing the dishes, making sure everyone gets a ride home, and that the fruits of those more patient labors, you know, may not be as satisfying as someone hungering for huge global answers. But that's, you know, then that's the definition of faith, right? You know, so that we don't get instantly all the problems of the world solved because you wrote a 1,500-page manifesto by yourself and figured out how to repel the Islamic invaders, you know, that you have to show up every day for your spirituality in a way that's in dialogue with the needs of others.
Terrific.
Yeah, and I guess one thing that I'd like to just add, since we're kind of on the closing end of things, is from a scriptural perspective, all the scripture that I've been privy to, whether it's the Book of Mormon, the Bible, I've read quite a bit of the Quran, and the idea in all of those books, at least that pops out to me, is that there are stories in there and there are concepts in there that I'm very uncomfortable with. And there are stories in there and concepts in there that I find hugely inspiring and life-changing. And I think at some level, most of us who follow these religions understand this concept. And this is why I have a problem with things being said over the pulpit about not being a cafeteria Mormon. Because I know that there are scriptures in our scriptures that have never been quoted over the pulpit. Mm-hmm. And for good reason.
Uh-huh.
And so those...
Preach!
And so we are choosing the good part of those books. And in a sense, we all have to do that at some personal level as well. And I think that, again, where the majority of us fall, we're able to do that at some level or another with some nuance. But again, if you have somebody who's very rigid and inflexible and grandiose and mentally ill, their ability to do that, of course, lessens dramatically. And so, you know, stories of people using, you know, biblical references for crimes is not that uncommon. And that's a problem. And that's where I wish that, you know, leaders of not only our religious community, but of others would do a better job of clarifying. Because and I think the fear, again, is that if we say one little part isn't true, that then people are going to say the whole thing isn't true. And I think that there are a lot of great nuanced ways to deal with that, where that would not be the case.
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking of is something along the lines of Paul saying, these are the fruits of the Spirit. If you're having a spiritual experience, you're going to experience X, Y, Z. And all of those are, you know, more loving, more patient, more long-suffering,
kindness.
Meekness, all that stuff. And so if we were just to constantly be saying, you know, righteous indignation, you know, yes, but that's... You know, when you're so worked up about something, it's probably not the Spirit. You know, the Spirit is going to certainly encourage you to fight for what's right. It's gonna, you know, get you off your butt and into the fray. But it isn't ever going to demonize another. It's gonna encourage you to want to work with persuasion rather than coercion and things like that. So I do think that's one of the ways that we can do it. These are the fruits of the Spirit. And if you catch yourself fighting into those, go into your own heart, go to your knees, work it out with God, and find out, you know, if there's something else at play there.
And also, Dan, I just love what you said. And also, if I can just add one more thing to that beautiful sermon, you know, not to otherize difference, you know, not to create radical categories of us versus them that belie the profound, you know, interconnection of all of God's people. And that applies in so many ways, and it even applies to rhetorical violence within our own LDS communities, and, you know, that fairly said both sides are guilty of. There are as many people who are willing to, you know, otherize Orthodox Mormons and make them, you know, out to be demons or, you know, evil in ways that are, you know, not fully reflective of humanity, as there are Orthodox Mormons who are ready to, you know, exclude and demonize unorthodox Mormons. So, you know, there's something about refraining from projecting other, you know, difference onto otherness that's really an important part as well.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, even though that this is, you know, we're talking about experiences that situations that are really horrific and that the majority of humans wouldn't ever contemplate being a part of, they still offer us a lesson. They still offer us a lesson in how far the human mind can go and what to be wary of and to be careful and, you know, all those lessons of accepting others and of loving others, because there's a lot of people who might, even though they would never act the way this man did, might believe or think or agree with some of his thoughts or you know, his beliefs about this.
And so Pat Buchanan came out and endorsed him, basically, and so did the Brian Fisher, the American Family Association, which is basically an evangelical group that has made a business of otherizing everyone from Mormons to gays to Muslims. They came out on record and said, yeah, you know, he has a point, this Breivik.
Right. So when people start, I guess my bigger concern is, I mean, even though this greatly affected many families in this country, I think what affects us all more is not so much the extreme fringe, but the normal fringes, where people are still interacting in what we would consider culturally correct ways, but that are still very harmful to our community at large, to our children, and to our international relationships, for sure. So I think that there's still, even in these extreme cases where we like to write them off and say, oh my gosh, that's just some crazy person, and we're, you know, nobody, that's never going to happen to us, or that could never happen to me, although that's probably true. Statistically, this kind of thing happens very rarely. I think that there are larger lessons to be learned.
Very, very good. Hey, you guys, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm trying to come up with some sort of summary. What did we learn today? What did we talk about? I know we
said love.
Hey, I like it. Very cool. Let's burn it down to that. That's awesome. But no, I appreciate the education, the reminder. Just I think it's good for us to dive for an hour into the chaos and whatnot, and just let it work on us a bit. But I just want to close with my own little. It's not.
Yes. My testimony. You were going there.
I kind of caught myself going there. I guess for me, the point that I don't know that I said it well or if it just really came out of, I tend to absolutely agree with you, Natasha, that religion can, you know, be a very negative thing in this whole business. But my sense is, and again, you guys can argue back, or we can just let it be my sense and then argue it out on the blog or something. But religion probably isn't the cause. But if there's something fundamentally going on with a person, you know, a narcissistic personality disorder, some kind of antisocial behaviors or whatever, religion is ready-made with symbols and stories and mythic characters and crazy proclamations and things like that. And so it does provide this rich language and these rich ideological matrix in which these underlying things can get blown up out of proportion. They can become exaggerated. Does that make sense to you? So I'm not ever wanting to say religion is to blame, and if there were no religion, this would never happen. I do want to honor the fact that you can go haywire, and if you're going haywire and religion is a piece of your worldview, it's definitely going to most likely be a playground for that narcissism, etc. Mm-hmm. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I definitely don't want to come across as somebody who's anti-religious by any means. I love my religion, and I think most people do have a wonderful connection and, you know, find a lot of use and value and worth from their religions, whatever religious framework they come from. So my only, you know, and an attachment to that is that religion does play into the nature versus nurture debate. I mean, it's definitely part of our nurture. It's part of our environment. It's part of our culture. It's part of what we grow up with. And so there's no way it can completely be separated from many human events that take place. So there's a balance there to definitely come up with. I guess my only closing comment that I'll throw out there is that we've talked about a lot of different tragedies tonight. And I don't know who all is going to listen to this podcast, but if by any means this reaches somebody who's been touched by one of those tragedies, I just want to throw out my love and concern and my apology that we're talking about these kinds of things because something tragic happened in your life.
That's a wonderful reminder, and I know Joanna and I would share that.
Absolutely.
Joanna, any closing thoughts? You gave us love one another. What else you got?
You know, if you feel like you need to write a 1,500-page manifesto, you know, try and not make it a solitary effort. Check in with somebody. you know, I mean, in all seriousness, I think there have been, you know, really laudable revolutionaries throughout human history. I think about, for example, the historical figure John Brown, who many readers might, many listeners might know, some might not, you know, a white man in the 19th century who was as committed to the fight to end slavery as African-American slaves themselves, and committed acts of violence in service of his cause. And, you know, I mean...
Wasn't that here in Kansas?
Part of it was in Kansas.
Yeah.
Part of it was in Kansas. And, you know, one of his acts was he hoped to commit a raid on an arsenal at Harper's Ferry to seize weapons that slaves could use in arming themselves to rise up and fight for their freedom. And that was his end. You know, and so, you know, there I still maintain that there's a place in history for inspired revolutionary action, but it seems to always work best when it comes out of a place of collaborating with others and of deferring to others and putting others' needs and ideas before your own. So, you know, that's something kind of as an intellectual historian I take away from it, that, you know, pride is a huge stumbling block to good historical change.
Well, and along with that, I think good revolutionary actions have not included, you know, killing our innocent children. So
yeah, basically.
That has never really, in my book, been beneficial to anybody's getting ahead.
Well, you two are just too great. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been a fantastic discussion. I had no clue which direction it would go, but I think we ended up bringing it home in really good shape. So thank you very much for your brilliance, and thank you, Mormon Matters listeners, for your subscriptions, your donations that you do, mostly just for listening, for occasionally getting to the blog and commenting and being part of these discussions. It means a lot to us to get your notes and messages, which tell us that you appreciate what you're doing. And we're grateful to you and plan to keep bringing you more stuff. So again, thanks very much, Joanna.
Dan, thank you. It's always a pleasure. And thank you, Mormon Matters listeners.
We love having you. Thank you, Joanna.
Thanks, Dan. It was a pleasure to be on again.
Natasha, you rock. Thanks. And we'll look forward to more interviews with you from Mormon Stories.
Thanks, Dan.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.